Hi, welcome back to the show. I'm joined now by Andy Sylvester, Campaigns Director from the Taxpayers Alliance. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
If you want to just explain in a nutshell kind of what the Taxpayers Alliance is all about.
Yeah, we're about 11 years old now, and we're an organisation that fights essentially for lower taxes and more effective government spending. And at the moment is obviously campaigning to persuade parties that when you're spending £90 billion more than you have, you should probably think more about spending reductions than spending pledges.
I mean, is there anything in this kind of, you know, we're less than a week to go into the general election, is there anything in what's happening at the moment that's giving you kind of confidence, that's making you happy as the Taxpayers Alliance?
Well, the bizarre thing is that all parties are talking about deficit reduction, or at least the two men vying to be in Number 10, both David Cameron and Ned Miliband, have pledged on numerous occasions that we will bring the deficit down at varying speeds, and Nick Clegg says he'll bring it down fairly, whatever that means. I had a boss who once told me that no one over the age of 8 should use the word fair, but that's a point for another day. Basically, so the rhetoric is very promising around bringing the deficit down. But what's more concerning is the fact that they keep reaching into the back of the Treasury sofa and dredging up some spare change, which we don't have, to find extra spending pledges.
Yeah, I mean, there's that great movie, that great Michael Durkin documentary, Britain's Trillion Pound Horror Story, when there's a great kind of reel of the various parties from across the spectrum promising to spend more, spend more, spend more. And this is just from 2010, this is, you know, 2008, 2009, 2010, as they're spending more and more of our money. And it feels a lot like that again at the moment.
Yeah, well, the funny thing is, it's never more true than in the case of the NHS. Right now, Labour are casting themselves, at least attempting to do so, as the party of fiscal responsibility by not pledging to spend £8 billion more on the NHS by 2020, which to me seems a slightly bizarre way of looking at these things. The NHS is one of those things that we've spent so much money on. You know, the budget doubled in real terms between 2000 and 2010. Productivity didn't go up, a metaphor for the British economy, perhaps, over the past few years. So we still measure things by inputs rather than outputs. And I think what you're seeing now with particularly the Tories and the Lib Dems both making such a big deal of spending £8 billion a year that, again, let's come back to this, we don't have. You know, it feels like there's lots of good noises, but not a lot of action, frankly.
I mean, the Conservatives, you know, from the very onset, from there, as they took over as part of the coalition, were labelled as the party of austerity. We had people rioting in the streets over the cuts that they're making. You know, how much of that is true? How much of the Conservative Party in this coalition actually been a coalition of austerity?
Well, this is the thing. For a group of guys that, frankly, have spent a lot of time in politics and understand spin, they've allowed themselves to be cast as a party of austerity and yet haven't really been that austere. You know, we're still spending, as I said, you know, 75 to 90 billion more than we bring in. That is half of what it was originally as a percentage of GDP. So there is a story to be told there that is at least in some way promising. But it isn't the kind of short, sharp austerity that we've seen on the continent, for instance, where admittedly the situations were better. I think the real problem is that we're seeing, again, lots of talk about austerity, but very little detail on where these cuts will come. The Tories, again, promised £12 billion in welfare cuts. We'd agree with that. The welfare budget is massive, and their record suggests they might be able to find it. But how? What are they going to cut? What are they actually going to come to the electorate and say, this is the pain we have to suffer? I mean,
have they run out of low-hanging fruit as well?
I think there is an argument that they have salami sliced. I mean, the first sort of couple of years of the austerity government were basically slicing 10% off non-ring-fenced departments, which is all very well and good, but then you're asking departments to really kind of find the little bits of administration efficiencies, and you wonder whether we might have, if not exhausted that, we're getting to the end of that particular road.
And yet there's an argument that that George Osborne has been very lucky to date in the fact we've had these depressed bond yields. You know, he's been able to go to the markets, borrow very cheaply. I mean, can you see that continuing throughout the next cycle?
That doesn't look terribly likely to me, but I'm bearish on gilts. You know. Well, I mean, have been for years.
Yeah, we're still spending £40 billion a year on debt interest payments. And that's, as you say, with ludicrously low rates.
So, do you think there's any chance of something like a balanced budget provision sneaking into a future government?
Well, what we've got now, it was passed just before the end of the most recent parliament that we've now dissolved, was the Charter for Budget Responsibility, which committed all parties, because Labour walked through as well, it's now on the statute book, to eliminate the deficit by 2018-19. However, we saw that in 2010 as well, when Alistair Darling did exactly the same thing and passed the Fiscal Responsibility Act to, again, balance the budget by 2014-15. Which George Osborne came in and said, well, this is meaningless rubbish. I have a plan, and we're going to follow my plan, not Alistair Darling's plan. So there's absolutely nothing to stop the next government coming in and saying, well, this is meaningless rubbish from George Osborne. We're going to follow my plan instead. So I think we have to be concerned whenever people think about putting things in law. It's all too easy to change it.
I mean, if you're a taxpayer, should you be fearful of of the SNP? You know, are they a danger to the taxpayer?
I think, I mean, all parties are making noises about austerity. They certainly are not. They say that austerity isn't necessarily the answer. They say that we will bring the deficit down basically through creating some sort of panacea of economic growth over 20 odd years, and that'll pay back the deficit somehow as tax revenues increase and they whack taxes up on the very richest. History suggests that raising tax on the richest, on those that invest, is not a particularly brilliant way to encourage investment into an economy. So I think there is a question there about whether they will be able to balance the budget. And as I say, like Labour, they are a lot more keen on talking about taxes on sort of higher and not even that higher incomes. You know, to people on double the average income could see their taxes go up.
Yeah, and the problem is every group they go after is the most mobile in the economy. That when they're talking about, we've seen lots of this kind of little war over non-DOMs, who are the most, they are by their very nature, the most mobile people within the economy who can easily take their bank accounts and move to much friendlier climates.
Yeah, I mean, what was
warmer climates.
Yeah, well, what was particularly concerning about, I think, that whole non-DOM debate was, it was a great political move. It, you know, positioned Labour well and truly on the side of people who aren't non-DOMs, I guess, and people who maybe don't understand what non-DOMs are, frankly. It's still quite a complicated suggestion. But I think what was concerning was that there was no real debate about the dynamic effects of doing something like that and the changes like that. And I also think, to be frank, we've had so much in recent years about companies should be taxed where they make their income. You know, we hear about Starbucks and Amazon and all that sort of stuff. If you make your money in England, you should be taxed here because that seems fair in some way. Why are individuals different was the kind of thing I was sort of raising as a sort of counterpoint. But yeah, it's one of those things, we keep seeing these little moves and little political moves, but again, that might have raised £1 billion. That's a drop in the ocean when we need to save 90.
Do you not think there's something rather cynical about the way everybody has conflated the terms tax avoidance with tax evasion over the course of the last few years?
Absolutely. I think politicians take great pleasure in defenestrating executives and non-DOMs in front of select committees and getting on the 10 o'clock news. But ultimately, it's their 17,000-page tax code. It's their loopholes. Mm. If they really want to do something about it, they should.
They're in the position to change the law.
Exactly. You know, we look at economies in the Far East, like Hong Kong. The tax code is less than 1,000 pages, and that's in two languages, and Hong Kong is hardly a non-complex economy. It is possible to have a simpler system that would allow us, when we see evasion and avoidance on, so to make the difference between them rather more stark than it is now.
I mean, I'm a fairly big fan of his, but Silvio Berlusconi, and in his cabinet he had a minister for simplification, and she was a former glamour model, and anything that she didn't understand was scrapped. I think that's a great law. It's similar to the former chairman of HSBC, who any kind of new bank policy that his secretary couldn't understand got rewritten, and that's a great move. I think the Treasury ought to bring in Jordan as a minister for simplification.
Katie Rice as minister for simplification, quite like that, don't you? It's an intriguing one, isn't it? And you're right, because firms in the city and so on and so forth that have large compliance departments and accounting departments can, of course, do this stuff. But small businesses, medium-sized businesses, businesses looking to grow from 50 to 100 employees, the extra implications that comes with that, the different ways you can do tax, I mean, it does take up a huge amount of your time when you should be doing something, frankly, more productive. Most people are happy to pay tax at a certain level, obviously not too high, because they understand that it has to pay for roads and things. But they don't want to see other people perceived as not paying their fair share, and it also just encourages avoidance further down the line.
And just to wrap up, you know, the next government of whatever flavour or makeup, what's the one big thing that you as the Taxpayers Alliance would like to see promised by the next government?
I think we'd like to see them stop pretending that tax rises are the way to get rid of a deficit. That isn't the case. Of course, government debt is slightly different from household debt, we get that. But ultimately, you can't keep spending way above your means. We see what happens on the continent when you do that for too long. And if there is a slowdown, well, we had some slack in the economy last time. That slack won't be there next time unless they deal with the issues right now.
Well, Andy Sylvester, Campaigns Director from the Taxpayers Alliance, and Tim Price, Partner and Director of Investment at PFP Wealth. Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Straight after the break, we're going to Darren Sinden, Market Commentator for Admiral Markets. See you after the break.